can I take just a few seconds out of the agenda and on behalf of all of us say special thanks to both Margie and Deb this morning. You weren't aware of it, but if they were given one third of a choice, they'd have been home in bed. Both of them are most unwell, and they've been working very, very hard to bring us into a wonderful worship time like they have. So thank you, ladies. We appreciate it very, very much. The story, I've probably told it to some of you before, but it's probably worthwhile telling again. It involves a very expensive, very fancy ladies' boarding school down in Sydney. And one day the janitor of this particular boarding school came to the principal and said, I've got a problem. These young ladies are going into the bathroom, and in the bathroom they had a great big row of sinks or whatever and a great big long mirror. And the ladies are going there and putting on their lipstick in front of the mirror and then going to the mirror and kissing the mirror and leaving a big slash of lipstick. And every day he has to come and scrub and scrub and scrub and try and get this lipstick off. And he said, it's such a job, and I've actually left messages out there, please don't kiss this mirror, and there's twice as many kisses there the next day. And I'm at my wit's end how to do it. I'm wasting so much time. She said, oh, we'll fix that, no trouble at all. So assembly the next day, she said, okay, all you ladies are to come with me, and we're going down to the bathroom. And she got them all crowded into the bathroom, and she said the janitor is having this problem with the lipstick on the, and they all, what's it got to do with us? We're from very, very expensive households. We couldn't care less what the janitor thinks. And the janitor has to, and so I thought it would be a good idea if I brought you all down here and the janitor can show you how he cleans the mirror. What a job it is. And they all, made faces at themselves in the mirror. And the janitor went in next door to one of the toilet cubicles and he grabbed a toilet brush and he flushed it round in the bowl and came out and started scrubbing the mirror. Girls rushing for the door. Problem solved. Nobody wanted to go there and kiss that mirror ever again in their lifetime. They probably never ever wanted to kiss a mirror again in their lifetime. Ah, yes. Sometimes God has to do things for us, like cleaning a mirror, to let us get a bit of an idea of something that's really important. And I had a moment like that some weeks ago. I was just reading, and I'm reading in the Old Testament, and I'm reading through one of the books of the prophets, and I'm just reading along, and I'm familiar with the story. I know all the background. All of that's okay. But one verse that jumped out at me, and in Hosea chapter 3, verse 2, it says, so I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a lethic of barley. And I just kept right on reading and reading and reading, you know, the way you do sometimes. And sometimes the mind goes wandering off somewhere else while you're reading. And all of a sudden, what was that again? And I went back and I read it again. And it said, so I bought her for 15 shekels of silver, about a homer and a lethic of barley. And I thought to myself, there's something in there that I've missed. There's something that I'm missing. There's something there important, and I haven't caught what it was. Now, I went and did some homework, and 15 pieces of silver, round figures, about 3 weeks' wages. Okay? So, okay, that was great insight. That was wonderful understanding. And the barley was about 10 bags of barley. And even though I'd done the homework and researched that and found out what that was, it still didn't seem to be gelling. I need to know a little bit more. And so I went back, and I'd already read the preceding couple of chapters, but I went back and read them again. And I've got to admit, reading the preceding couple of chapters and coming to that chapter again shattered me. Can I have permission to share it with you? Can I have permission to take you for a walk on the wild side? We're talking serious talk on the wild side. If you go back to chapter 1 in the book of Hosea, the word of the Lord came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, sons of Joash, a king of Israel. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go, marry a promiscuous woman, and have children with her. For like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord." Sometimes the Lord asks the prophets to do some unusual things. Go down to the house of the potter, watch the potter at work. Lay on your left side for umpteen days, and then lay on your right side for umpteen days. But I've got to admit, while some of those were easy and some of them were a little bit more difficult, if you understand what was coming, then what Hosea was asked to do was heart-shattering. I don't believe that the lady that he was called to marry was the ugliest girl on the block. I got a sneaking suspicion she was probably a fairly attractive young lady. And so being called to marry her might sound like, oh, well, that's not so bad. But King James Version the NIV sort of drifts over just a little bit. And as we read some of the other Bible renditions, Gomer, the young lady in question, wasn't just a promiscuous young lady. Promiscuous young lady who would have a boyfriend on the side occasionally and had made a habit of in the past, but now that she's married, that will probably stop. No. Gomer sold her body in the street to anybody who had the appropriate sum of money. Other renditions pick it up. She was a harlot. She was a whore. She was a prostitute. And I can begin to imagine the discussion that went on in the home of Hosea the prophet when he went and had a chat with his father. See, marriages back then weren't individual affairs. Marriages were family affairs. You don't get married without talking over with your father. And he will discuss with you the family that you're planning on marrying into, because you're going to marry the whole family. And I can just begin to imagine. Hey, boy, what you talking about? Do you know who she is? Do you know the family she comes from? You're thinking of marrying her? The shame and disgrace just by marrying her. And what happens if after you're married she continues in that lifestyle? What are you going to do then? No. Don't break your heart. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Whatever you do, don't do it. Welcome to the world of the prophet. Welcome to the world of the pastor. Welcome to the world where God says, I want you to fall in love with the unlovely. And people will come to you and warn you, you need to avoid those people. You don't want to let them in. And why don't you throw them out of your church? But it seems like God has inoculated. Seems like God has given a divine injection directly into the heart of his own love for people. And in spite of who he knows Gomer is, he still goes ahead and marries her. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Prophets are often got a message of repent or else, turn or burn. This time, just like deciding kissing the mirror isn't a good idea, sometimes something is done that is so shattering. And he wasn't just told to marry this girl just for fun, but he was told to marry this girl so that the whole nation can see how God feels about their rebellious ways, about the way they have turned to other gods as if they were committing adultery of the spirit, and as a husband would be upset by what she was going to do, then God is upset with what we as a nation, we as a people are doing. And so the whole of the book is actually quite interesting, because the story is told both in dialogue and narrative. But it is emphasizing by life the heart of God. And can we get that and understand? When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, he said, go and marry a promiscuous woman. So he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim. You can add in between there, obviously they had family discussions between them all. And she conceived, after they were married, she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to Hosea, this is part of my message to my people. Call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel. And you can go and hunt that out for yourselves. It's quite an interesting story. But tucked away inside there is just a little bit of a prophetic word as well. You see, if you go to the town, the village of Jezreel, you can look north. And as you look north across a great big plain that goes off for 20, 30 kilometres, and in the far distance you can see a little village on the hill, a place called Megiddo. And the place you're looking across is the place where the last battle is going to be fought, the Battle of Armageddon. God is going to bring. And there was just a little hint tucked away inside here about that. Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to Hosea, call her Lo-Ruhamah, which means not loved, for I will no longer love Israel, that I should forgive them. After she'd weaned Lo-Ruhamah, Gomer had another son. And the Lord said, call him Lo-Ami, which means not my people, for you are not my people, and I'm not your God. And we sort of get the picture of a happy home, don't we? Father, mother, two sons, and a daughter, all living together. But there is, even in that last child, there is just a little hint that things weren't quite what they seemed. tucked away in there, if you listen very carefully, you hear a little quiet voice. He's in my home, but I'm not sure that I'm his father. Because that happy home, which should have been a happy home as a reflection of God and his people, was a reflection of God and his people. And as I read chapter 2 is virtually a lament. And as the prophet at a much later date laments to his sons about their mother. And as we piece that together, we realize the agony that Hosea lived through during those years. I guess it wasn't all that noticeable for a start. Just every now and then, a visit down to the shop took 3 hours instead of half an hour. Then one day she went to the shop and the shops had long closed before she came home. When she came home, she didn't have the groceries with her. She'd taken 5 pieces of silver to get the family groceries, but now she counts out her purse and there's 25 pieces of silver and no groceries. Then there's a knock at the door, and oh, I've needed the office, I'm going to be gone for a while. Then accidentally she doesn't come home one night. And he knows. He knows. But he pretends to look the other way, because this is the girl that God told him to marry. And her unfaithfulness is a picture of the unfaithfulness of God's people when they start walking away from loving and serving him. And it breaks his heart. One day she's gone, one evening. She's going to... And he says, well, you know, the shops are shut. Yeah, but what about the late night place down the road? They'll be open, the 7-Eleven. And he's drawn to go and see where she is when she hasn't come home a couple of hours later. Instead of turning left and going to the 7-Eleven, he turns right. Just feels himself drawn down into the red light district. There's young ladies, miniskirts and fishnet stockings, if you like, under the street lights, and some of them accost him as he goes past, but no, he's not looking for, he's looking for a particular lady. And he finds himself standing outside of a nightclub and looks inside the door, and a big ugly bloke comes across, you're coming in, pay your admission, or you get away, you can't stand there gawking. He stays there and keeps looking and keeps looking, and eventually he sees, leaning up against the bar, his wife. And she's leaning her shoulder on this sleazy-looking bloke. And the bloke reaches out and pats her, and she pats his hand. And then he continues to maul her and grope at her. And he's standing watching this happening to his wife, and he's waiting for her to turn round and slam him for what he's doing. But she laughs and pats his hand. And he goes home and cries himself to sleep. She doesn't come home for some time. But when he does... he pretends Nothing has happened. He loves her. She starts staying away for days at a time, weeks at a time. He discovers that she's got a nice unit down in the middle of the district, and she spends a lot of her time there. And she's got all sorts of expensive gifts that men have given to her. And she lives a great life, plenty of money. But every now and then she does come home. And 3 o'clock in the morning, he'll realise there's somebody in the bedroom, and next thing the blanket's being lifted and she's snuggled in beside him, and he reaches out and pats her and he says to her, "I love you." She's heard those words 300 times in the last 2 weeks. But both she and the people uttering those words know that they are hollow, meaningless words of the trade. Don't mean a thing. But this time, she realises this is the truth. He loves me. Home for a couple of days and then gone again. And this times away become longer and longer, because every time she comes home, those words of great love pierce her heart. And she can't bear to see the sorrow in his eyes as he comes to say goodbye, unaware of who she's going to be with and how long she's going to be away for. Do I paint the picture? And life goes on. The interesting thing is, none of us stay young forever. And some lifestyles will knock the age on very, very quickly. And suddenly, her life has changed. She used to go to a nightclub, and as she walked in and sashayed across the floor, the band would stop and then start up a beat in time with her walking. All the spotlights would turn from waving round and focus on her as she made her way across. And the men would fight and argue with each other to come and be close to her and tuck $100 notes into her undies and all of the stuff that goes on. But now she walks into the club and everybody ignores her. She finds herself sitting over in the corner, everybody ignoring her. And all of a sudden, she finds it hard to make a living. She goes to the pawn shop. That mink coat, she loved it so much when he gave it to her. He was a sleaze bag, but mink coat was nice and he had a lot of money. She took it to the pawn shop, and the guy at the pawn shop knew that she wasn't coming back for it, but they pretended it was just for this next couple of weeks. Then she went to the pawn shop again and again until her unit is bare of all the treasures she had and there's not much left beside. She'd run up an account down at Food Works and they're starting dropping hints that she can't buy any more unless she pays cold hard cash. You know, she can't get any clothes anywhere. The guy she's renting the unit from is telling her she's 6 weeks behind and she better start catching up and there's no money. And one day she goes out and there's a huge parcel on her steps. There's food, there's clothing, and she digs down. There's a bag of money tucked away inside there. You know, even in our very worst, our God still keeps providing for us. And her husband was aware of what was going on in her life. And as a picture, as a reflection of God's love, has come round. But she pretends it came from her. She thinks, one of her fans from down at the club, and goes that night and looks around, but everybody's avoiding her eyes. And she knows where it comes from. She knows where it comes from. And it keeps going for a little while. Could you believe? Nights get lonely when you're by yourself. And suddenly, nobody wants to be with her at all. And so she takes some of the money that has been so generously provided by her dear husband, and she pays blokes to come and keep her company of a night time. And the world falls apart for her rapidly. And then one day, a guy from Food Works, the landlord, guy from up the road, knock on her door. They have a bailiff with them. We've come to take everything. Everything of value that there is in this place. There's not much there, but they take everything. Out of generosity, they allow her to wear the clothes that she's standing up in, but everything else goes. And she said, what am I supposed to do now? They said, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You're coming with us. There's a slave auction on Friday. Your centrepiece. Come Friday. And they take her and parade her with other slaves that are being auctioned. And before the gawking crowd, they strip her naked, so that they can all see exactly what it is that she's going to be buying. She tries to cover herself up, but they rip her hands away. She's nothing but a filthy piece of trash. And nobody would be interested in bidding for her at all. The auction starts and somebody bids five. She turns to the guy standing guarding her and says, what's that, 500 pieces of silver? He says, honey, get real. That's five. No more. And I don't think they're getting a bargain at that. Somebody else bids 10. So, hey, how many of you have been to an auction where there's something you really, really wanted up on auction? You been there, done that? And you have a look through the piece of paper the auctioneer has given out, and he has said expected bids, you know, between, let's say, $5,000 and $8,000. What do? Do you go along, because you really want it, do you go along with $2,000? No, you really want it. Do you go along with $5,000? No, you go along with... You go along with $8,000 and as much as you can get together, because this is something you absolutely long for. This is something you absolutely want. You've stripped the house to make sure that you have something just in case somebody tries to outbid you. Just in case somebody wants to go 10, you've arranged to make sure that you've got 12. You know what I'm talking about. And we get a picture of this when the auctioneer takes place and somebody bids 15. And suddenly there's a movement in the crowd. The auctioneer's hammer is raised, ready to drop it down, and he realizes somebody is coming forward to speak with him. And there's whisper, 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 whisper. Ladies and gentlemen, my friend here has said that he's willing to bid 15. That's all the cash that he has. But he does have 10 bags of barley, he's willing to add to the 15 pieces of silver. Do we let her go? This piece of trash? For 15 pieces of silver and 10 bags of barley? And he takes her. She is no longer his wife. She is now his slave. Now, in those days, wives didn't have a great deal of protection, I grant you. But they did have some. But a slave is owned, lock, stock and barrel. He owns her completely. He can do anything he likes with her. And she has no comeback at all. And she has shamed him. She has disgraced him. She has put him through so much torment. And now she is just a worthless piece of trash. And it is his opportunity to have vengeance on her. To tear her to pieces, and she can do nothing about it. He drags her home. Piece of rope around her. He's taken his cloak and wrapped her up. And he gets her home. And he gets a big knife. And he cuts the rope. She is now free. Honey, can I get you to come with me for a second? Can you come and help me? Please, can you help me? Margie doesn't know about this. She doesn't know whether I've got the knife here or not. But here she is, this person who has brought him so much pain, so much disgrace, and she is now totally in my control. And he grabs her. And he grabs her and holds her. And she holds her head down in utter shame. And he holds her. And he holds her. And then he releases her, and his hands go around her back, and he holds her in, and she's anticipating a huge, horrible bear hug that will squeeze the life out of her. But he just holds her. And she hears her head against his chest. She hears a rumbling of a voice. She pulls her head back to hear what he's saying. And he still holds her. And he looks into her eyes. And he says, I love you. I love you. Hey, can you get it? We have dishonored, we have disgraced our God so much. We have put other gods in place of him. Now you're all saying, no, that's not us. We're pretty cool. We're pretty good. We've never gone out and committed adultery like that, or we've never. I got news for you. Every single one of us have put gods in the place of our God in our lives. Sometimes it's money, sometimes it's home, sometimes it's family, sometimes it can even be our church, it can even be religion. One of the biggest Buddhas you'll find sitting on God's throne in our heart ends up with a face like a mirror. Me, sitting on God's throne. And when we have done that, we have committed spiritual adultery. And God has every right to wreak his vengeance on us, just as Hosea had the right to wreak his vengeance on Gomer. But instead, he says, I love you. How much did we say he paid for her? 15 pieces of silver, and emptied his house of everything that was valuable to buy. Hey, heaven emptied itself of its most precious, precious possession for you, for me. This Friday, we remember the crucifixion of our Lord Jesus. Two arms outstretched. Heaven emptied of its very best, so that Jesus himself cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because even God himself can't bear to look. heaven has emptied itself of its best for us. But his arms are outstretched and he simply says, I love you. Church, brothers, sisters, friends, can I emphasize for each one of us to remember, every one of us, have put gods other than him onto the throne of our lives. Every one of us have committed spiritual adultery, just like Gomer did to Hosea. But his response is always, I love you. Let's pray. Father, we can't begin to understand the pain that you feel from our rejection, but we thank you that you come back with that response, your eternal love, and we accept it for ourselves today. Thank you once again.